We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. One thing that we can say about natural disasters, things like tornadoes, floods, earthquakes, these things will occur. We just can't say when. So here's a question we want to talk about this morning. How do you get people, both individuals and people who are involved in government, to prepare for an event that can be, likely will be, hugely destructive, but is also something that is highly unpredictable? This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Professor Richard Silvis. He's professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware. He writes and does research on disaster policy and environmental policy. And he is someone who is certainly a longtime observer of emergency management and also the politics of disaster. And in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about what we can learn by taking a look at past disasters and the response. I'd also try and talk about what government at all levels can do to better respond, perhaps also a little bit about what individuals can do. And all of that is open for questions from people who are listening. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He developed the first course there at University of Delaware on politics and disaster in 1988. He continues to teach that course today. He is the author of a recent book that you might want to take a look at if you're interested in this subject. The book is titled Disaster Policy and Politics, Emergency Management and Homeland Security. It's published by the CQ Press, Congressional Quarterly Press. Is out now. You can seek it out. And he is joining us by telephone. Professor Silvis is joining us by telephone. So questions here are welcome. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can do that by calling us. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We also have email, so you can pass your comments, questions along that way. Will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, people who are listening are certainly welcome to participate in the conversation. Professor Silvis, hello.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. To yourself?
Very good.
Good. And also, I do want to mention here right at the beginning that Richard Silvis is a graduate of the University of Illinois. He got his PhD here, so we're pleased to have you with us.
It seems another age. I was probably between 25 and 27, 28 when I was in Urbana-Champaign a long time ago, but those are some of the best years my wife and I had. We went out to Urbana-Champaign together, and I got a terrific education from the political science department and the University of Illinois. And it's interesting now I'm at University of Delaware, and I feel I've traded being an Illini for becoming a fighting blue hen. So that's our mascot here at the University of Delaware. But it's been a good career in academia. I've been most of my years, I taught 2 years at University of Cincinnati after leaving Urbana. And then I taught, that I've taught ever since then at University of Delaware, and I will be teaching in part of my retirement at George Washington University in D.C. And I really like the field of disaster policy and emergency management, although that wasn't the field that I studied in Urbana-Champaign, but it was a logical offshoot of my work in environmental policy.
Well, as this is something that you have been thinking about studying, working on for some time, you have a good perspective here. And, you know, I think right now, if we ask, I'm sure if we ask people who are in your field, or perhaps we ask people who are first responders, or, you know, people who are concerned about this, if we ask a broad kind of question, and you think of whatever kind of natural disaster would be likely wherever you are, and if you ask this question, how well prepared are we? Or maybe you might ask the question, are we well prepared enough? I expect that the answer we'd get back, probably most people would be no, that we're not well prepared enough. Now, certainly these questions have come up a lot. They've come up since Katrina here in the United States, for example, 9/11. I'm sure that looking at what's happened in Chile and Haiti, people ask these questions. What strikes me is if you go back, say, even in this country, back before Katrina, and you look at some of the kind of responses you would have gotten to that question, it seems that they're much the same as we get today. That is, no, we're not well prepared. Would there ever have been a time when we could have said, as far as disaster preparedness, our ability to respond, we would have said, yes, we're ready to go?
Well, it's a very good question. It's a complicated question. The easiest way for me to explain this is that there's really four stages to look at this at, and that is disaster mitigation, disaster preparedness, disaster response, and disaster recovery. And the United States, Americans as a whole, are pretty good on disaster mitigation. That is, our building sciences are really excellent and often cutting edge. And engineers, including many at University of Illinois, have been very instrumental in developing resilience in buildings and the capacity to take hits from a variety of atmospheric or seismic forces that strike them. In addition, you know, the United States has a very elaborate system of emergency response, emergency medical, the fire people, police people, and that community is well-schooled in emergency management concerns. Now, it varies in some remote locations or rural areas that may be a little less than elsewhere, but on the whole, as a country, our responders are very well-trained and well-educated, getting better, and I'd like to think I'm one of those people that contributes on the higher education side, advancing the professionalism of those people. The response phase, we're pretty fast in the response phase. The recovery phase is only beginning to get great attention. We spend vast sums of money on recovering from disaster, and it's sort of a way in terms of American intergovernmental relations that what state and local governments couldn't get or thought they deserved in federal aid, they kind of make up to a degree through the government assistance, the federal, the state and local assistance they get in disaster declaration funding from Uncle Sam. And for your listeners, I have a website, and I did give it to Ms. Williamson, your assistant, that is a website you can visit to find out the disaster declaration history of every county in the United States from 1953 to 2008, and we're updating it now to 2009 to get President Obama's disaster declaration to this point. And it's nice because in three or four keystrokes, it's very easy to use. We set it up so that if you had a child in junior high school, she could produce a disaster declaration history in three or four keystrokes and make a table and bring that to show and tell in school and make a presentation about it. So we set it up to be very user-friendly for people to be able to see how many tornadoes they've had. A lot of people live in places for only a 4 or 5 years, and they figure, disasters never happen here. We don't have these risks. And if you actually look at the big picture for 40 or 50 or 60 years, you see that there is records and it is sensible to prepare. One of the things I'm concerned about, having spent time in the Midwest, is tornadoes, and I still have a major fear personally of tornadoes, and I think that the Midwest and other places are doing better in terms of providing tornado sheltering for people, particularly people who live in mobile homes and need to escape. I guess the warning time now provided by the National Weather Service is something on the order of 8 to 10 minutes, maybe even better than that, so that if you have a warning that there is a tornado in the area, that you have a chance to make it to a shelter and escape the possibility that you, where you live, would be hit by this, because you probably won't survive it. If it hits particularly a mobile home, you might have something of a chance in a house, but it depends on the wind speed and, you know, where your home gets hit and other types of things. Of course, the Midwest is very familiar, as is many other regions of the country, with flooding. And right now, seasonal flooding is a major concern. Certainly the Red River area of the country with the snow melt and that type of thing. And the country is very well experienced with flood and has very, very capable floodplain management people. We just need to make sure people at the local level use their land use authority responsibly and do not approve excessive development in floodplains where you have homes and people, businesses exposed to flood risk through different periods of time. So maybe this will get us started in talking about
it. Okay. We have a caller here I want to get to, and let me also very quickly reintroduce, in case somebody has just joined us, reintroduce our guest. We are talking this morning with Dr. Richard Silvis. He's professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware. He does writing and research on disaster policy and environmental policy. And we're talking about disaster planning and how well prepared we are to deal with some kind of major disaster. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here, I believe someone from Naperville on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have firsthand knowledge of some of this stuff. I'm a retired emergency services worker.
Yes.
And, you know, I think the public is well aware of what's out there as far as, disasters, especially here in the Midwest. What I find intriguing is around where the hurricane areas are, hurricane-prone areas, they don't seem to be as well prepared as somebody might be in the Midwest or even the West with the fires. Mutual aid is another thing out here that's really helped a lot of people, towns, cities, all helping them. But the one thing that people have a misunderstanding, like Katrina, is that the local, and this is goes for all emergencies, that the local emergency service people, whether it be the town, the city that they're in or the county, whenever something happens, they have jurisdiction before the feds, and the feds only come in after somebody has requested them. And that's what happened in Katrina. The mayor there didn't request them, and he was kind of forced into doing it, and he was ill-prepared, and, you know, it ran amok because I know somebody worked down there, and it was a disaster from the bottom up, not from the top down. And everybody wanted to blame, say, our politicians like George Bush or the Republicans, which is, it was ill, you know, fated. And now they, not to say that they didn't have a hand in it, but I grew up in Southern California dealing with earthquakes and in fires too, because it was a fire department. And the thing that saved us was mutual aid and awareness, preparedness, especially if you lived in the foothills that were very prone to fires. And I'll say this, they probably, to me, to this day, have the best mutual aid that this country has that I've ever seen. It's getting better in the Midwest, but there's still no cooperation between law enforcement and some of the emergency workers areas. Plus, a lot of these rural areas don't have a lot of money. I was wondering what you came up with, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for your call, and I'm glad to hear you're from Naperville. My brother used to live in Naperville, but at any rate, your question about hurricane-prone areas being perhaps less prepared for hurricanes than they should be, one of the phenomena that you get in the Gulf Coast area and in Florida, the areas I'm very familiar with, and I have family down there, as probably many of the listeners do, is that many people retire to that location, and they don't have memories of hurricanes on those locations because they haven't lived there long enough. And another tendency is that people move to those locations, and they tend to want to build homes that are very similar to the homes they had in other regions of the U.S. that are not the right design homes for the wind speeds that hurricanes generate in those areas. And so you end up with very beautiful, expensive homes, but homes that are very vulnerable the hurricane force winds, and therefore you get excessive damage there. So that may be part of what's going on in that region of the country. Another factor, I compliment your observations on mutual aid, and it has made a great difference in approving and essentially leveraging the capacity of responders to deal with major events that confront people almost anywhere in the country. People's perception of emergency management at the local level, people watch national television often, and they get national media sources, and they have a tendency to think that FEMA will be coming to their door to rescue them, and they don't realize that they don't often see or recognize that they have local emergency management people there responding on a daily basis to the issues and incidents that are not disasters. But when disasters come, they're the people that step into the breach and are the first responders that are there to deal with the misfortunes that they confront with that disaster. And so what I'm getting at is that it's kind of human nature that what people see on television, they assume will be the case when they face an issue. So they think, well, I have to see a FEMA person coming to help me. And I've worked with people in FEMA, and I've worked and I've interviewed people who were disaster victims. And oftentimes people can go months and sometimes years and never see a FEMA person after a disaster, even if they live in a presidentially declared disaster area, because you've got local people, you've got state people, you've got FEMA contractors that are coming to inspect homes, and it's those people they see. They don't really see the three or four thousand FEMA people that are there. FEMA is a very small agency, but it has sort of a high profile because of the media. Yes.
I want to pick up on something else that the caller said, because on the response recovery side, we might find ourselves having to help people who chose to live in vulnerable areas. And probably the great case study would be coastal areas that are vulnerable to hurricane. But you might also include places that would be flood-prone, places that would be fire-prone. Do you think that government should be more heavily involved puts us on the mitigation side, I think, really more heavily involved in regulating where people can live, or by building codes, maybe, saying, okay, you're going to live in a particular place, here are the kind of risks, and here's the kind of structure that you're going to have to put up, or else you're not going to be able to live there. Or maybe there might be some places we just have to say, as desirable as that might be for a house, that we're just going to say, no, you can't build there.
And that's a great question, too. I want to say that your listeners might be wondering why a political scientist is talking to them about disasters. Well, disasters are incredibly political. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that things are. People expect that government will provide them help of some kind. Now, people can insure against disasters. You can buy national flood insurance. People have insurance on their homes that covers them against wind and fire. But often people are underinsured for the risks that they face. And in some instances, government and private sector people encourage risk-taking on the part of people who will be moving into areas that have a higher probability of hurricane or wildfires or other things. In addition, that's a function of personal taste. Some people love living inside or on the periphery of national forests, but they have to realize that there are natural burning cycles that those forests will go through, and if they're too close, their structure may be involved in that burning cycle. If you live on a coast, Atlantic coast or the Gulf Coast, you have to be prepared for the possibility you're going to have a hurricane. But people often rationalize that, well, for the one incident I'm going to face in 15 or 20 years for 2 or 3 days, it's worth it to have this property and to live in this location and take this risk the rest of the time. Sometimes they realize that it was a bad decision, but oftentimes they're lucky and they don't sustain the worst, or they are wealthy enough to self-insure and simply rebuild if government isn't providing the insurance or they don't have a private insurer, and they just simply build back the house in the exact same location. Now, the problem is government shouldn't build utilities back to these structures and encourage people to live in very high risk. Along the coastlines, they call them V-zones, where you have major possibilities of storm surge pushing inland from hurricanes. A storm surge causes an immense amount of damage and hurricanes, and it's often improperly understood by the general public.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Spring Bay, next, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Well, the conversation turning toward the political aspect of it was kind of what I was calling about. If I were a politician, if I were a president, I think I would really want to get the FEMA right, the emergency response right. That would seem to be a very wise political move, because a lot of times it would be maybe people's only sort of connection with the federal government and create all kind of goodwill. Previous caller talked about it was the mayor of New Orleans' fault. I think that I just cannot accept that, to blame a mayor for the federal response to a disaster, I don't think has any merit. I remember in the Clinton administration, there were three disasters in a row, one maybe in Florida, one in California. Anyway, it just seemed overpowering. And I thought to myself at the time, hey, you know, this is pretty good. Federal government's doing a pretty good job here. And I took some pride in that. And I think Bush's putting Brown in there at FEMA was an act of contempt to the American people, putting someone obviously so unqualified into such a position. I'll get off and listen to the rest of the conversation. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
I agree with the caller's comment that it's very important for presidents to get FEMA right. And some presidents have done disaster policy well, and other presidents have not thought it important to give it much of a priority. In some presidencies, the FEMA director takes months and months and months to be confirmed and appointed, appointed and confirmed and assume the position. We've seen FEMA folded into the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11, and there's a huge debate, including in the academic community, about whether that was a good idea or a bad idea. A friend of mine, James Lee Witt, would love to see it made independent, move back to where it was from 1989 to about 2002 when FEMA was moved into Homeland Security. I know many other people who feel that it's better that it's kept in Homeland Security. There's elaborate national response plans, which is now National Response Framework, and the Incident Command System, which is a tactical side for dealing with disasters in the country. And it makes sense to have the terrorism side interweave the natural disaster side, because it's the same people who will respond to these events when they occur around the country, and it makes sense to include them in this. Whether the management of these things, I guess one of the concerns I have is that there's a tremendous centralization of authority at the federal level in the disaster policy field, and it gets more almost every day. And what I mean by this is that there's an expectation that people at the local level will be following a plan that is consistent for the country as a whole. And the idea was to have seamlessness in dealing with events like 9/11 intergovernmentally throughout the country. But in reality, it sometimes straitjackets local people, or it constrains local authorities who have to deal one place to the other with different types of disaster threats, different types of hazards, and you know, have different resource bases and all kinds of other things, that number of personnel and so on, that affect their ability to do their jobs. It's important to get FEMA correct. I think FEMA will probably have to stay in Homeland Security for the indefinite future. And I think that as long as Homeland Security people and FEMA people can find ways to work together and cooperate, that the country's better off for it, and that people counting on what these organizations provide will be satisfied. But when there's internal competition in these departments, when presidents don't give enough attention to appointing capable people who are experienced in the area, Michael Brown is an example of someone who kind of, if you remember those matchbooks, Learn While You Earn, he kind of had to learn that job. And he probably gets more criticism than he deserves because he had done a fairly reasonable job, but he did delegate a great deal of authority to his day-to-day managers within FEMA for the disasters before the Katrina disaster. The comment about mayors being prepared, well, mayors do have culpability for and responsibility to the people. But obviously the magnitude of Hurricane Katrina was regional. I mean, that event penetrated 200 miles inland. So 9,000, I forgot the acreage, but just the four states affected by this, hundreds of counties, massive area. So many mayors, many county officials, many local officials had to deal with that event. And it's very difficult to affix blame as for why Katrina was handled as badly as it was. There's a lot of blame to go around. Some of it is at the federal, some of it's at the state, some of it's at the local. But I won't be the one to say who was most responsible. I don't know, and I think it's probably a shared responsibility for that. And they've worked and worked and worked to make sure that doesn't happen again.
We're just a little bit past the midpoint in this first hour of Focus. I'd like to introduce again the guest, Dr. Richard Silvis. He's professor of political science and international relations at University of Delaware. He does research and writing on disaster policy and also environmental policy. He developed the University of Delaware's first course on politics and disaster back in 1988, and he continues to teach that course. He's the author of a recent book, Disaster Policy and Politics, Emergency Management and Homeland Security. Published by CQ Press. So if you're interested in that, you can go out and look for it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have another caller I want to get onto in just a moment, but again, to pick up on some of the things that really both of the callers said, to what extent is disaster response complicated by questions of where the lines of authority are between local government, state government, and the federal government, how government on these levels communicates, and the very basic question of who it is that should be in charge.
Okay. Now, there's a tactical side to dealing with incidents, which disasters create are referred to as incidents. And there's a technique called an incident command system. And the idea there is that you have a pool of people led by an appropriate local official responder who is in charge, usually through an emergency operations center, to deal with that event. And there are representatives of the agencies involved in the response that work at that center and that work through this person. It's a very elaborate system that works all the way from the local level to the state level to the federal level. And there are times at which local authorities, if they're overwhelmed, can basically ask the state to take over for them and assume many of their duties. So this rarely happens. It's unusual that an entire county is affected to the point that the responders themselves can't do their jobs. But when such a thing does occur, there are provisions for this type of response. In addition, the way the procedures work, the policies, the states are supposed to prove to the federal government that they are incapable of dealing with the disaster or event that they are confronting. But capability is financial, and what that because every state has to maintain a balanced budget. In disasters that cost money are judged as creating an incapability, and therefore a justification for a presidential disaster declaration. So we have a system in which the federal government is often asked by states to deal with disasters of various types. Fundamentally for financial reasons, because the states do not have the money to meet all the financial needs that are produced by the event, and because there's a compassionate component in it, which the federal government wants to be responsive, particularly through the presidential level, to the needs of the people in that particular area. So there's a political thread and a financial thread that runs through these lines of authority. Your question about communication, the system of communications is just amazing. I mean, just the capability, there are small armies of people that work the communication side of disaster and that are quite good at it. I think this country is probably ahead of almost every other country on its ability to communicate before, during, and after disasters through all kinds of, through cell technology, fiber optic technology, you name it. We have a capacity. Plus, 9/11 created the Defense Command inside the United States proper, and part of the mission of that NORTHCOM is to provide that communication is maintained during emergency circumstances. So we even have the military augmenting our communications capacity. So that's a major factor. I don't know if I've answered your who question, other than to say that who's in charge is a function of the nature of the event itself, how expansive that event is. You may conceivably have multiple emergency operation centers if you have a widely expansive disaster. If you have a disaster that affects 30 counties in Illinois, you're going to find that there's going to be at least 30, probably many more, emergency operation centers with people in charge who are dealing with the disaster in their area. And as the previous caller said, working through mutual aid often to ensure that resources are properly distributed over that disaster area.
All right. Let's talk with someone else in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I want to pick up on some points that you raised earlier, and the other callers raised earlier. I have experience mostly in California, both on Northern California, Southern California, with earthquake responses and fire responses, which are two major issues that are recurring in California. I was involved in various local government agencies there. And the issues that have been touched on, which I'd like you to talk more about, have to do with, one, the fact that really people want to live in areas that are dangerous. They want to live in areas, as you said, near national forests. They want to do things that are dangerous in those areas, whether it's in terms of their landscaping, their housing, and so on. In terms of earthquake-prone areas, they want to build the way they want to build. And, of course, earthquakes and fires go together in some areas. And the abilities, both legal and financial, of local governments to do anything about this is very limited and is very politically unpopular until there is a disaster. Therefore, it doesn't get done. There are also issues of private property and constitutional issues that are quite difficult to get around. So that I sort of thrown things up. I could talk about specifics, but I'd rather you dealt with the issues that way rather than talk about the Loma Prieta or various other earthquakes or various forest fires.
Sure. All right. Well, Professor Silves?
Oh, those are great comments. I would agree very much with the caller that there is some degree of risk-taking, but the tendency when you're an emergency responder, as the caller is that you kind of see people at their worst, or you see the cases of people that appear to have made foolish decisions in terms of where they lived. But the average person may not see that they have put themselves in a risky circumstance. And so that there's, for every person you see who's a victim, there are hundreds, thousands more who don't see themselves as potential victims and are taking similar risks. The private property point at the end is really an excellent one, and that is that in this country we do have people, free use of their property. We do not have federal zoning. That is, the federal government doesn't come in and tell local governments how they should engage in land use. To some extent, our Constitution almost prohibits that type of thing, and it's just customary that this not be an area that's heavily preempted. But when you have the resources coming from the federal government, when states and localities are expecting vast sums of money to come from the national treasury. Much of that often is borrowed to pay for disasters. You end up with an incongruity because people say, well, I want to freely use my property the way that I want, and I like to build structures. I'll give you an example. I once talked with a lawyer in Texas, and he said that he often took cases by people who own property on the coast who decided to build structures in the sea. They would put seawalls and other things in to keep the sand from eroding, but they would affect their neighbor, and their neighbor would lose sand. And because Texas was a state in which private property rights are very much treasured, and they very much resist government interference, people who were victims of their neighbor's behavior ended up going to lawyers and saying, well, how can I sue my neighbor? How can I get government to prevent my neighbor from, you know, stealing the sand that's logically mined by the structures he's put on his own property? So we end up with these conundrums where we want our property rights. We don't want people to tell us what we can and can't do with our property. But nevertheless, what people do with property around us and what other parties do affects our own property. It affects the value, and it affects the risks that we take in living on our own property by the behavior of people around us. So it's a very, very difficult problem to confront, but I'm glad the private property issue was brought up.
Well, I needed to jump in here because we're coming into about our last 10 minutes and I have another caller. It sounds as if what you're saying, though, is there are these two things that are in tension. One is our interest in trying to limit damage and to people and property, and the other is this this strong sense we have of private property right, that it almost sounds as if we're saying that that there's not a true balance here, that the one really outweighs the other. That is, the private property right seems to outweigh the other. And as much as we talk about how we could and should use things like zoning and building codes to prevent people from building in vulnerable areas where they might experience damage, and then the government's going to have to come in and do some remediation and compensation, it sounds as if that maybe we just have to live with that because we really think that private property right is so important.
Well, it's not as hopeless as it might seem. Certainly, this is a free country, and every one of us, including me, treasure private property rights. But there are ways in which government can subtly influence my behavior. If I buy a property in an area, let's say, that has a hillside that erodes frequently, and I choose to build a house in a very high-risk area, which may be subject to landslides or serious erosion when it rains, and I'm foolish enough to build my house there, I want the government to build utilities out to my house. I want water and sewer out to my house, and government has the right to say, based upon where you've got your house on that property, we're not going to provide you those utilities in the way that you want. If you want those utilities, you can put them in yourself, but we're not going to use your tax dollars to support a house that we consider in an untenable location. You put it in an appropriate location, we'll provide you the utilities. People want their driveways to connect up with roads, and if they want to live in areas that are in high risk, particularly where they might be posing a threat to other people. When people decide that they're going to live in national forests, you have to realize that they're putting firefighters at risk who may have to come and rescue them in these circumstances. So there has to be some connection on the part of private property owners, what kinds of obligations they impose on other people by the behavior they engage in on their own property. But I am not saying government should come in and tell what private property owners should or shouldn't do on their land. That we don't do in this country. That we shouldn't do. But there are ways in which exchanges and education could work to the benefit of both the private property owner and the local governments involved.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Richard Silvis. He is professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware. He does writing and research on both disaster policy and also environmental policy. And we are talking this morning about disaster planning and response, both in the state and the national level. Our telephone number here, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. And as I said, we're moving into about our last 10 minutes. Callers will help us by being brief. Let's go to Champaign next. They're next in line, line two. Hello.
Hi. I certainly, from the standpoint of disaster, agree that, you know, the common good, we have something, you know, in other words, our fellow Americans and all that kind of stuff to help out. One of the areas that really concerns me is where we have the thing where corporations and stuff creates potential disasters down the road, and what happens is that sometimes nothing is done. I'll just give two examples of there. One is mountaintop removal, these poor people that are down, you know, the water and all that kind of stuff. And recently there was a documentary on Gasland where, in terms of fracturing, you know, under these people's homes, yeah, they did give the right to drill in the whole bit, but now in terms of contamination of the water, and, you know, all of a sudden then people are standing on their own. So what's your perspective there?
Well, now you're talking about an environmental hazard, and this is another very, very important subject. Your mountaintop removal example and your Gasland example lead me to draw people's memories to Centralia, Illinois, where coal mines were abandoned below a city, and they caught fire, and the fires are still burning, and the fires may burn for 100, 200 years. They're almost unextinguishable given their circumstances. What sometimes happens is that corporations engage in certain types of behavior. I know that in the Midwest you've got agribusinesses that are engaged in certain behaviors, and runoff from properties carry certain chemicals. There are responsibilities that attach to these things. Both the Environmental Protection Agency and FEMA have some responsibility for regulating the behavior of corporations, but not FEMA as much as EPA and a number of other federal agencies that are in the business of let's say, worker safety, that are in the field of environmental protection, the agricultural agencies that are there to make sure that the land is responsibly managed. These are all important duties that should attach or be applied to corporate behavior. Many corporations know what the right thing is to do, and corporations, particularly that sell directly to the public, do not want a bad public image by practices that are irresponsible or controversial. Also, in this country, we have a very sophisticated legal system, and if you can prove a corporation has done you wrong, you may be able to get compensation. Now, that may be insufficient recourse, but nevertheless, it's an option. It's a path that people have that they can use sometimes when they feel they've been aggrieved by a corporation in some way. Yes.
I hope that gets at least in part of the question of the caller. Again, we're getting short on time, and I want to move to another Champaign County next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, there's a whole lot there in corporate disaster manufacturer, I guess one might call it, or something that, and I'm not reassured that lawsuits and those kind of things are really the, it's sort of getting back to something where there's not so much state capture by corporations is really where that's at. That's political science lingo. But I earlier wanted to formulate a question on just its overall assessment of how, you know, major disaster response is going. The pyroclastic flow from Mount Rainier, the possible New Madrid fault line. I've heard various assessments of that as far as how bad St. Louis would be affected in the latter, and it seems that people can't even really decide what the implications are, and I just wonder how much overall planning there is on that, and I know there's not enough time to really do justice to that, but your mention of Northern Command really strikes a nerve with me, though, and because it seems to me that's a centralized Pentagon response is really not the way to go. It seems to me National Guard, a real National Guard with where people who are volunteering to the National Guard partially because of response to a regional disaster phenomena with governments and compacts, and that is a really more down where the action is kind of thing, rather than sort of expecting the Pentagon at the Northern Command to do this. And perhaps they are trying to integrate through that mechanism, but it seems to me that it's not reassuring that that's something that one would point at as it seems more the regional. And anyway, I hope you're getting my point, and I'll hang up and listen.
Yes, and all three were very good points. Let me talk to Mount Rainier very briefly. Not only the recognition is that Mount Rainier may be a volcano. I mean, it's understood to have been a volcano in the past, and it could erupt again. The concern is not only with the pyroclastic flow, the gases that would be emitted in an eruption, but Mount Rainier may go through a cycle in which you have you don't actually have an eruption, but you have the magma chambers get close enough to the surface at the top of the mountain. It melts the snow, and so rapidly it produces lahars, and the lahar washes down the rivers and causes immense devastation. And I know people out there who their communities are practicing for the possibility of such an event. Now, about the New Madrid possibility, the idea that there could be a major earthquake in the central part of the United States with an epicenter not far from St. Louis, Missouri, certainly there is a history of that. And I want to put in the listeners' minds, I have a student from Haiti who was affected by the earthquake in Haiti, and her family was affected. And I made the claim, why wasn't Haiti better prepared for the earthquake? And she said the last great earthquake that Haiti had was 200 years ago. 200 years ago. Well, New Madrid was 200 years ago. People in the United States, just like Haitians, don't have a living memory of a great earthquake. And so they're not prepared for it. So in the same sense that Haiti wasn't really prepared for this earthquake, well, Midwesterners may not be prepared for a New Madrid quake, because 200 years is an immense period of time between those phenomena. And certainly earthquakes don't follow logical cycles. They have their own periodicity, and there are other seismic factors and geologic factors that account for when they occur. The last point I want to make is that I compliment the caller for pointing out to me the importance of the National Guard, and that's something I should have pointed to earlier in my discussions. The National Guard does an immense amount of work in the disaster field in the United States, has done so traditionally for a long, long time. These are citizen soldiers. These are often people right out of the communities affected by these disasters. They have a great esprit de corps. They are fantastic at mutual aid with one another. They have military resources they can bring to bear. They can go into zones and live self-supporting. They don't need to take up hotel space, other things. I can't say enough good things about what the National Guard does. NORTHCOM is a challenge, NORTHCOM being created by the military to prepare against the possibility of another 9/11-type attack against the homeland. There is tension, admittedly, between the NORTHCOM people and some of the National Guard people. I'm probably going to get complaints about that, because for as many tensions there are good positive relations that exist between these two, but there are some tensions between them. NORTHCOM has some difficulty trying to determine where they fit with conventional emergency management, because as active military they have a chain of command, and the nature of authority systems in emergency management are not compatible with that rigid a chain of command, where local people salute, take orders from the state people salute and take orders for the federal government. Doesn't work that way in civilian emergency management in the United States. And some NORTHCOM people logically as military may think it's necessary to work that way in extreme circumstances. And that's where there may be tension between NORTHCOM people and civilian authorities. But this country has civilian authority running the military, and the military is accountable to civilian governments. So it's not something I'm necessarily worried about, but it is an issue. Thank you.
I'm really sorry that we are up against the end of the time, because there are many more things I would get to. Just real quick, and we're only going to give about 30 seconds. You made the observation, somebody, that FEMA is now part of Homeland Security, and our emergency disaster response in this country really has grown out of civil defense. It was based initially in the idea that it was something that would be doing in response to an attack. Now, that might still happen, but one wonders, is that really the right model if what we're talking about, the more likely thing being some kind of natural disaster?
Well, FEMA is a civilian agency, and we have great experience with natural disasters. There's many, many more natural disasters than terrorism disasters. But there are a growing pool of human-caused disasters of various types, and some of them involve, issues surrounding, biochemical releases, bioterror, epidemics, other types of things that, we need to concern ourselves with. The civilian side is still paramount in what this field is about. It needs to remain civilian, and it's the way in which the public education about disasters has the greatest potential to move forward. I think that when I started in this field, people laughed at me. I would go to publishers with my manuscripts, and they would say, "Who cares about disasters? No one cares about disasters." And then 9/11 happened. And now everybody cares about disasters. And I'm sorry it took 9/11 for this to occur, immensely sorry, but clearly people have gotten the word, and more Americans, including students. Students want careers. Students see jobs in this particular field. They see that it's a worthy profession. They see that the profession of emergency management and the field of disaster policy are very interesting fields to work in and can do a great deal of good.
And pardon me for jumping in here. Sure. We're simply going to have to stop. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'm sure we'll try to get back to some of these issues again on other programs. We just have enough time to say thanks to our guest, Richard Silvis, professor of political science and international relations at University of Delaware. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much. Bye.